When we get this up and running, we're going to be out of here.
Stanford, Morehouse, Spelman.
Hey, bring me along. Hey, whoa.
We proved that time travel into the past is possible.
If we just give it some time.
It's scary, but you inspire me.
Welcome to the 23rd episode of Zero Hour Strikes, the show that covers DC's 1994 crossover event, Zero Hour Crisis in Time. Every issue, every tie-in, every zero issue now. I'm Siskoid.
I'm Bess.
And in this episode, we look at a batch of young hero books, Anima, Damage, Gunfire, and Xenobrood, numbers zero.
Who are these people?
Not the best remembered characters, I have to admit. I put them all in the same bag, so...
Yeah.
Rip the Band-Aid right off.
This is going to be the who? Episode.
Do these people even have who's who entries in any? No, because the loose leaf who's who was the last one, and it was before 0 hour. So,
oh, okay. So I don't need to call the girls
or the guys. Who's who is Shag and Rob, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking of Ohatmu.
I'm not sure these people would get high marks on the Ohatmu circuit.
I'm pretty sure they wouldn't.
The costuming is, I don't know. Maybe Damage.
Maybe Damage. But, I mean, this is early 90s. I mean, 1994. For young heroes, this is a celebration of 1994.
Okay. Let's just get into it. Let's get this done. When we read the Anima tie-in, because we already covered Anima, we didn't know what was going on, right?
Yeah.
That's my memory. But yeah. I remember we thought it was still intriguing.
It was.
And listeners were quick to tell us it was not. So will Anima number zero be a better entry point than the previous issue, which was issue 7? This is where the series was up to. Well, let's find out. Anima number zero by Elizabeth Hand, Paul Whitcover, Steve Crespo, and Will Blyberg. It's called Zero Summer, so at least it's got a zero feeling to the issue. Mm-hmm. Anima's brother, Jeremy, is hanging out at a music festival where he meets a couple who want to get tattoos. Jenny has been dreaming of one for a while, and she's drawn it on a piece of paper. When the lineup is way too long at the tattoo tent, they go to an alternative, a tattooed man called Roki, anyway, there's no C in there, Roki, who lives in a camper and shows them impossible videos of the war between the Arkai and the Nameless One, recounting how these gods were created by humanity walking the Shadowlands in dreams or in death. From the collective subconscious, basically. He also shows Jeremy a scene of his sister telling him her origin story and warning him that, like her, he's a gateway for an Arkai. This is like the name for the archetype gods. But it's Eris, and she's bad news. He seems to forget all about it after Roki presses pause and soon finds himself in line for the dream tattoo that's evidently connected to the Arkai, like everyone else.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought was going on in this comic.
This is, we're already understanding more than the last time.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that cover before we get into the story proper. It has some very contrasting colors. I'm not saying it's appealing. So you've got some sort of glowing swirl in the background. You've got Anima, well, the monster, the Animus, I think, in red, green eyes, giant in the background. And then Anima, the superheroine, flying in front of that in, you know, cool colors. By cool, I don't mean appealing. I mean blues and greens. So
blues and greens, yeah.
Yeah. So as you may sort of get here, I don't think this is a particularly good cover.
Well, it's not. It's a cover.
I'm pretty sure it was stapled onto the pages.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, color-wise, it's made to make Anima pop. I think the idea was to be kind of mystical, I guess, with the spiral in the back and this Animus creature. But it's kind of boring.
It's super boring.
I think that's my problem with this cover. It's just boring.
Yeah.
At first glance, I wouldn't be like, ooh.
It would actually have been better if they just like blown up the Anima herself and have her on some sort of abstract background and just have her like really big coming at you. I think that would have worked better. And have popped more than here, where the figure's kind of small and you're not sure what's going on in the layers in the background. And you, you're not sure what's happening, or really you don't care what's happening. So this is kind of a fail. The interiors are fine in that way, but yeah, the cover, kind of lame. So let's talk about the story. I think one of the things that we have to address every time is, how is this an entry point? How are they recapping a character, their origin, you know, their backstory, so that the new reader can get into it? So in this case, they've really decided to take a break from the storyline that we weren't understanding in issue 7. Whatever, in the zeitgeist somewhere, and, you know, the fights with Anima. Anima's not really actually in this, other than flashbacks, let's say. So instead, we're seeing her brother Jeremy. He's learning the history of this world, this universe. And then also, he's getting that recap of Anima's origin story itself. So what did you think of this approach?
Both approaches. I mean, when we read it before, it was confusing, and it's still kind of confusing. I mean, it's this dreamscape type thing, right? The collective unconscious. It's kind of a big bite. It's kind of cool in a Freddy Krueger type way. I mean, if this was a horror comic, I think it would be better, but as a superhero comic, it kind of weirdly is uninteresting.
I think the problem for me is that it wants to be, I'm calling it COD Vertigo, where it's in the Vertigo style, both art and story, and just like the words that they throw about. Like, I get it. They're trying to be Alan Moore, or they're trying to be Grant Morrison, or, you know, Peter Milligan, or something. You know, that's the kind of prose, but it just feels like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And it's just like these strange gods fighting in this, you know, that's the video that we're being shown, the war between the Archai. But I don't have enough context. And when they talk about the context, it's mumbo jumbo. So it doesn't work. And I feel like the two-pager with Anima recounting her story in a very colloquial, familiar style, just a sister talking to her brother and being kind of witty and normal prose.
Yeah.
That works. I felt like, okay, now I understand this story from whatever was issue number one to this point. Now I get it. And it's just done in two pages. Like, that is more effective to get me in than two or three videos, or I mean, they're supposed to be videos, two or three bits of the larger mythical story, and we're seeing cave people and shamans and how it's affecting them through history. That's all, I don't know, surplus to requirements. It's like, I don't know what I'm watching. I don't know what I'm reading. And then, since this book is about Anima, when Anima tells her story, okay, now I'm caught up. Now I feel like I could get issue 8, and I know where I was in the story, but not because of those legends or whatever Roki is telling.
Roki, who looks a lot like Frank Zappa.
Does he have the mustache? Is that the mustache?
I think it's the mustache and the big black hair.
Yeah.
He looks like a wise old rock star. And I mean, it's all part of the thing. It's all part of the thing. I mean, it's all part of this kind of sex, drugs, and rock and roll type.
Well, if it's Frank Zappa, then no drugs.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just like, you're pushing for a needle drop, and I don't even know which tune you want me to play. That actually fits the story? I don't know.
This comic book kind of feels like a dream theater song, you know? I feel the mystical things, but I don't get what we're looking at. And you kind of hit it on the head when we were talking about the cave people having this, all of a sudden, Anima or these gods coming in and
yeah, I guess it's like the earlier generation of these gods manifesting through people.
The comic book is confusing right up until Anima speaks.
So
it was the first one I read in this series that we're covering right now. This was the first one I cracked open, and I really wasn't into it.
No, and I have to, like, there are some good visuals. I like the tentacles coming off the mother, the caveman mother. I like the baby shaped, like the gate shaped like a baby, the gate in reality or whatever. Some pretty good visuals at times.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that maybe all those tattoos, everybody's getting the same tattoo because they all dreamed about it. And it's also going to unlock something. You know, it's like everybody gets the tattoo, suddenly something bad's going to happen. I like the supernatural, the horror, or like urban fantasy idea behind that.
Absolutely.
But otherwise, I mean, it's like the previous issue. What's happening? And if you weren't there for the issue one, I feel like you're lost. And even so, maybe you're lost no matter what. We're talking about music. This is like a festival that's supposed to be a palooza kind of festival type, you know, they invented one, I think. The only artist that they reference really is like Liz Phair. I was like, that's one.
Yeah.
Wasn't Superboy into Liz Phair when we did the Superboy Zero tie-in?
I think he was.
Yeah. Does she have a deal with DC Comics or what? Why is everybody into Liz Phair at DC in the DC universe?
I don't know. Maybe she writes under another name or something.
Is it possibly Elizabeth Hand?
I'm saying yes. Let's start the rumor. This is how that works.
Based on this issue, it sounds like you wouldn't have picked up the next issue.
No, I seriously wouldn't. I'm confused enough as it is. I mean, the art isn't that bad. And of course, it kind of mixes in like aspects of this dreamscape and a bit of mystery. And the art is still clean and fun and bright. But I just wouldn't.
Neither would I, and obviously I wasn't reading it at the time either, but this seems like, I swear to God, if it were a Vertigo title, I would have been buying it because I was a Vertigo nerd, and I was getting even Vertigo series that I didn't think were that great. I was pretty much still getting them. So if this were a Vertigo book, and it looks like certain Vertigo books that have become like more or less forgotten today, and I don't remember them much, but I like that kind of art, that kind of story.
Yeah.
I have plenty in my long boxes. Anima just happened to not have the right branding.
Yeah.
So, okay, next up is Damage. It's also a series we covered in our previous go-around. We already know he's going to join the Teen Titans as per that.
Yeah.
Team's number zero issue. But this is still before that. It's between Damage 6 and 7. And I'll remind you that the series would last 21 issues in all, but that eventually Damage, as Adam Smasher, joins the JSA. He's probably the most long-lived character that we're covering today. Okay, so what happens in Damage number zero? It's by Tom Joyner, Bill Merriman, and Don Hillsman. It's called Back Again. It goes like this. While the bad guys, the Warum family, who control Symbolics and also Baron Blitzkrieg, plot to capture Damage and get access to his metagene, perhaps is the key to creating Nadia Warum's superhuman body, or to Blitzkrieg wiping all the metahumans off the face of the Earth, Damage returns from Zero Hour distraught. Wave Rider gave him this absolute control, but now has taken it away. And to make matters worse, Iron Monroe keeps insisting he's not his father, which makes him go into a rage. He blows up a city block, then gives himself up to the authorities, which no doubt means Symbolics now has him. Monroe, buried in the explosion, crawls out and gets on a boat where he seems unusually slow to heal. It's almost more a story than it is Damage in a way, because he's the narrator here. So if we look at the cover first, I know this cover. I have it in my long boxes. This was not my jumping on point. I'll reveal it now. It was my jumping off point, because this is the last issue I bought of Damage.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. I think I was culling some titles, because it doesn't end like, oh no, I don't want to read this anymore necessarily, but I don't have any issues after this. So in other words, I jumped off with this issue. Maybe it was like giving it a last chance.
Yeah, probably.
At least he's coming back from Zero Hour, so we can feel that it is a sequel to Zero Hour, which doesn't happen a lot in these Zero issues.
No, actually, I kind of enjoyed that, because we've been reading a lot of these, and I was not that I'm forgetting that Zero Hour happened.
That's what the show's about, and yet we don't get to talk about Zero Hour much in this section.
I was kind of expecting talking about Zero Hour and you know, how it it rebooted everything and how it restarted. And we didn't really do that because the Zero issues are not referencing it a lot.
No.
So this is one of those where we reference it. So that was nice. But we were talking about the cover.
Actually. Yeah. And I mean, it's damage. He's...
I think he's jumping. I think he's coming down with rubble. But this is, once again, one of those covers. It's a pinup cover. It's damage being damage in a very damagey way. So it's basically a pinup cover. This scene probably is in the comic book. I mean, there he did destroy a whole block. My thing with this cover is that Damage doesn't look like a kid. He has all these lines in his face and he looks old.
Because he's so angry, he's you know, his face is sort of pinched.
Yeah.
But I do like it because I like the shading on it. His hands are glowing, so it kind of casts a shadow, maybe. I don't know. There's like a lot of shadow on him.
Well, his face is lit up because of that, so that's nice.
Yeah. So I like the way it's shaded. You know, if a lot of Zero issues are going to be pinups, because it is supposed to be an introduction to the character, so you want it to be introductory, and I think pinups are very introductory. I think this is one of the better ones in terms of colors and design.
And there's Kirby Crackle in there, so I always enjoy that.
Sure. And the Damage logo is kind of, because it's exploding, it's kind of going all over the place. It's over the banner stuff, and I like that.
There's a lot of movement in this one.
Yeah.
Compared to the other one, compared to Anima, this one has movement. This one actually has action. This one also flows nicely with the Damage logo, the Zero Hour logo, which is also kind of a weird explosion. And, you know, everything is moving in this. So, I mean, yeah, this compared to Anima, this one is very nice.
If we go into the interior, the problem the writer had here was, how do you tell, like, if these Zero issues are supposed to be like recaps and origins in some way, how do you tell an origin when the whole point of your first year, at least, is the mystery of Damage's origins? You know, so you can't tell it because you're already in the process of telling it. What it becomes is this big fight between Damage and Iron Monroe. It's like, tell me my origin! No! And so there's explosions.
Yeah.
It's kind of like refusing and very violently to tell us the story of Damage because we can't tell you the story of Damage yet. Okay, Zero Month,
exactly.
Don't force us. And if you force us, we'll blow up Atlanta. And that's what happens.
That's what happens.
Yeah. Here's the thing about this. I don't know if Monroe is lying or if later writers ignored, like, don't remember this issue. Because Monroe says he can't be Damage's father because he's infertile. Infertile.
Well, no.
Well, okay. But in Manhunter Volume 3, the one with Kate Spencer, he proves to be fertile because, and we saw in the previous issue of this, the actual tie-in, that in the time wave, Monroe and Damage meet the Phantom Lady. And the Phantom Lady says, oh, is that our son? You know, there's a thing like that. So obviously she's had a kid by Monroe, so he can't be... He wasn't infertile there, so I think maybe he's lying. In Manhunter Volume 3, we find out that, like, that kid that they had became Kate Spencer's father, and that his grandson, which is Kate Spencer's son, or I guess it's his great-grandson for Iron Monroe, he gave birth to a man who gave birth to... Well, a man doesn't give birth. You know, who begat...
Father.
Who begat Kate Spencer. She begat a son, and that son had some of Iron Monroe's powers.
Yeah.
So, in other words, he's not infertile. And if you want the whole story of that, they conceived a child out of wedlock. They called him Walter Pratt because they gave him up to adoption. And they had the Adam, Al Pratt, kind of broker that because they were so shameful that Phantom Lady trusted Al Pratt with this. And he gave it up to adoption. And because he's the one that delivered the baby at the orphanage, they put his name on the birth certificate. So that's why Walter is a Pratt, which sounds like an insult. But so it's Walter Pratt, even though his true father is Iron Monroe. And then what will happen eventually, if we're spoiling Damage here, Al Pratt is Damage's actual father.
Okay.
Which explains why he becomes Atom Smasher later and has like an Atom look. But this is all a mystery at this point, and Iron Monroe is clearly not wanting to accept the paternity thing here.
Do we ever see the reason why, maybe, you know, his motivation for keeping it a secret? Do we ever see that somewhere? Do we? I mean, I'm asking a big question.
Yeah, well, you're asking a question that's probably answered in Damage. You know, by the time that they reveal the true father, by that time, the human bomb is also in the book. So you were thinking, oh, is it the human bomb? Because Damage is obviously like a...
explosive powers.
It's basically the modern day human bomb, but it's not. So there's a lot of like these red herrings, and eventually it turns out to be Al Pratt, and probably... they talked about it in the previous issue. They have to address it eventually, that Iron Monroe, no, you know, my kid is someone else or whatever.
The 90s are full of these, I'm lying, this is lying, this is a red herring that we're not going to tell you. And then they surprise us with something that a lot of people go, what?
Well, the 90s like shock value, because the 90s is really the decade where, started in the 80s, of course, but the 90s are the decade of speculation and the boom in the comic book stores, you know, the direct market. And so we're having people trying to push shock revelations. And I mean, it's basically the way that some TV is made now, you know, where there's got to be like big shocks, big reveals, big, and, you know, that's how they were pushing a lot of books in the 90s to make sure the comic book shops were buying them, whether that's hot artists, you know, like the Image guys or whatever, or, you know, the death of Superman, or, you know, like these big, big events that made people buy comics. So how do you get people to buy Damage, which is just this little superhero book that just started? Well, you want to keep it, you know, it's like, oh, there's going to be a big shock, a big reveal. And I think that's part of this.
And it just feels so 90s. I mean,
well, especially like this is my disappointment reading this. Damage just helps save the universe. He's the one that restarted the universe after Zero Hour.
Yeah.
He's the source of the new Big Bang. That's a big deal.
It is.
He comes back from saving the universe. He's the big hero. He's, without him, non-existence, right?
Or boring universe where,
Hal, you know, Jordan universe.
You know, boxing gloves, everything.
Yeah. So he comes back, and instead of being transformed by this, and I understand that he loses like the fine control that he felt he had with Wave Rider's help. But all he does is rage and destroy things and attack Iron Monroe. And is like, tell me you're my dad. And it's, what is this? He wasn't even this extreme in the previous issue. This doesn't exactly endear me to the character.
Yeah.
If this is the follow-up to him, like, let's say I'm reading Zero Hour and I'm not reading Damage. He's in there. He saves the universe. I said, well, maybe Damage is... an interesting character. Maybe it's worth following his book. You know, maybe they're really investing in him. And then you pick this up, and it's just like this big moronic fight.
It just feels like a temper tantrum.
Yeah, there's not much motivation, and he feels like he's 14 or something, and doing this. So really, the only reason I would have kept reading Damage is for Iron Monroe, is for eventually Human Bomb, is for the Atom, because I'm interested in Golden Age characters. But of course, this isn't a book that's really sold on the back of that, because it's like this young 90s hero. And if you're interested in the Golden Age, like if you're an All-Star Squadron fan or a JSA fan, this isn't exactly the type of comics that you're interested in.
No. But to be fair, they do try to, you know, with the Baron
Blitzkrieg. Yeah. And if we're looking at like these sorts of books that are throwbacks, well, like Starman, which we haven't gotten to yet, but Starman is a legacy book, and you're going to feel that although it is set in the 90s and there's a 90s feeling, not a 90s extreme feeling, but a 90s feeling.
Yeah.
Contemporary feeling, it is also a throwback to the Golden Age and to the history of DC Comics. This is trying to do that, but I don't think it's working. I think the villains have, except for Blitzkrieg, have these very 90s names, and they're working for corporations. And I get that it's doing that, but it's not really selling the book to the people who would be interested in that. Starman is going to be a very nostalgia-driven book. This isn't about nostalgia. This is about a young, hot, new hero. So people who want the hot young new hero probably couldn't care less about Iron Monroe, etc. And if you're interested in Iron Monroe, etc., you're just going to resent this raging man-child with his 90s haircut. You know, it's not...
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think the Damage really finds his groove until he joins the JSA as Atom Smasher. You know, I don't think this character really works because he's got one foot in one world and the other foot in the other, and it doesn't quite mesh, I don't think.
It could be a fun contrast to do, you know, very contemporary versus All-Star Squadron-y, you know, Freedom Fighters type. But I don't think it really gets to that. Let's just say it's not that good for a zero for a zero issue.
Well, here's a question anyway. Would you, based on this issue, would you read Damage?
I would not. I loved him as Atom Smasher in the JSA, and I'm a big JSA fan, and I have a lot of these books right here, but I would not pick up Damage. To me, Damage is like the whining Wally West when he picked up the mantle from Flash, and he was just whiny. And before, you know, Mark Waid got into him and made him something, I think this is like whiny Damage. I really don't.
And as we know, I did not continue with the book. And looking at it today, well, I know all the answers because I did some research, but if I'd known that Human Bomb was going to show up, and maybe I would have stuck around because of my interest in those characters. At the time, I did not have that information, and Iron Monroe was not enough of a Golden Age concern because he wasn't actually a Golden Age character. He was an implant. He was created later and inserted into the Golden Age. I didn't have that feeling for him. Okay, so we'll take a short break. We come back. We'll talk about Gunfire and Xenobrood. Things can only look up.
Dr. Fate.
Dr. Midnight.
Starman.
Johnny Quick.
Wildcat.
Power Girl.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Firebrand.
Amazing Man.
Huntress.
Cyclone.
Sandman.
Mr. Terrific.
Stargirl.
Commander Steel.
Our Seven Man. Soldiers of
Liberty.
Infinity Incorporated.
Those are just some of the celebrated and beloved heroes associated with Earth 2 and the Justice Society of America.
These daring mystery men and women banded together in 1940 to form the first super team in comics.
They inspired a decades-long legacy of heroes who would follow in their footsteps, and now they've inspired us to launch a new podcast.
Justice Society Presents, a new anthology on the Fire & Water Podcast Network featuring a variety of themed shows with different hosts celebrating some of their favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond.
Join the fight for justice and subscribe to Justice Society Presents on the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
We're back, and now we're going to cover two books we've never read, not a single issue of before. I same for you?
Never read. Never knew they existed.
I knew Gunfire existed. I did not know Xenobrood existed. And, I mean, I was reading comics at the time, so you can well imagine. Gunfire, let's start with him. He was just starting, so he didn't take part in the Zero Hour event. He was on issue 5, so probably just telling, like, his first arc. I'm not sure what I can tell you about Gunfire, except that he was created in Bloodlines, like Anima. An alien sucks out his spine juice, and it gives him the power to basically turn anything into a gun. He gets his own series, which lasts 14 issues, including this one. Then he is absorbed in Blood Pack with other Bloodlines heroes. And then Ultimate Fate, he gets his hands cut off in Final Crisis.
Oh.
Pleasant. So Gunfire number 0 by Len Wein, Ed Benes, and Brian Garvey. It's called Forward Thrust. Gunfire and his team are tracking a villain called Ragnarok, who has been waging attacks on Gunfire's company. Turns out it's his own father he thought killed by the Spine Suckers. They fight. Ragnarok escapes.
Yeah, that's about it.
Pretty slim here, but okay, well, let's start with that cover. We've got, again, pinup. Gunfire is making something glow, I guess. We can't really see it, but he's like punching the air almost. He's got chains all around him, so he's blowing up his own chains, basically. And the background is a computer-generated image of a black hole. You know, it's like this funnel.
Yeah.
Green on black. I mean, the funnel, I don't think, has anything to do with anything. But
no, it's just to show us that he's probably a technological... A superhero. He kind of is. He has this exoskeleton that helps him fly and glide. And I don't know if the exoskeleton gives him strength or is...
I'm not even sure it gives him the power of flight, because when he drops on the castle, on Ragnarok's castle, he uses a glider. And then later, when he explodes the castle, he flies out. And it's the only place we see him fly.
No. We see him fly at the start. His belt is connected to his rocket boots.
Oh, yeah.
He flies a bit at the start. But but still, I think the rest of the powers, he has the powers to create. His power is basically creating energy bullets out of matter.
Yeah, he makes molecules vibrate and then... And the thing, the object, has to be kind of phallic so that there's like an end to it, you know, a barrel for the gun. So he shoots energy out of the object, and eventually the object disintegrates when it's out of energy, of atomic energy.
Yeah, it's very phallic then. Yeah.
Well, in this issue, he finds out he has other powers. It's still very early for him. Yeah. So when he sort of charges up a snow globe, but because it doesn't have an end... You know, it's a ball. He can't shoot energy out of it. He can't direct the energy, so it becomes a grenade. So that he learns he can do that as well. So he's a little bit like Damage in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Or one of Flash's minor powers, you know, vibrant. Yeah. It's a police not really police, but like a PI investigation. Feels like military or police. I don't know what it was.
He runs a tech company. You know, that's where he made the armor. And then there's like attacks on his company and whatnot. You know, some heroes obviously are fighting crime to fight crime, but he's really just defending his company from Ragnarok's attacks.
That being said, I really didn't care about this.
No.
I was like, yeah, you're protecting your company. Hey, good for you. What's going on in the world?
The character design itself. I think Len Wein, you know, was one of the great Bronze Age writers. I think he's uncomfortably pastiching the 90s style with this, trying to make, you know, like everybody's got a really terrible name, like Ragnarok. Ragnarok's pile of bodies outside the castle to show how, you know, how badass he is, how extreme he is. And Gunfire himself was really like a shitty version of Gambit charging up cards and throwing, you know, this is essentially what Gambit does and kind of what Gambit looks like.
Yeah, it's like, you know what? He's basically, if Gambit had a baby with RoboCop, he would look like this guy.
And there's even like one of the characters in his crew calls him Cher. Like she's obviously supposed to be Cajun or something. This is all part of why I hate Gambit. There are so many reasons why I hate Gambit. So when I say this is a shitty version of Gambit, I already think that Gambit is a truly shitty character. So... So it doesn't help.
He calls her Mademoiselle. And I'm like, oh, don't even. This is New York.
We're not in New Orleans or anything, are we?
Exactly. And the lady character is basically just there. She does nothing, even though.
Another Gambit thing. She's got a white streak in her hair. So she's Rogue. He's Gambit. Ugh. And Ragnarok is, well, he looks like one of these 90s X-Men villains.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, like the dad didn't die, and he also has powers as per the spine suckers, but also he's going to wear armor, which is also what Gunfire is doing. You know, it's like exactly like Gambit. Like Gambit has mutant powers, but also he's going to wear like this tech armor, but also like he's going to be the world's best thief, but also he's going to use a quarterstaff.
And everybody knows quarterstaffs are the most efficient weapons ever.
They might be, but not those metal ones. Like if you've ever seen actual martial combat with quarterstaffs, part of the power of the quarterstaff, it's made of wood and it's pliable. So there's give to it, and you don't see it coming because it bounces. You know, it kind of twists towards you, and you don't get that with a metal rod. So anyway, right, again, this is, for me, like Len Wein is trying to do the 90s style. He's been instructed to do the 90s style, or he knows that this is what's hot right now, but he's not a 90s writer, whatever. And so the art also, I mean, Ed Benes is an artist that I came to very much dislike on Justice League because his main interest was whatever's happening, it doesn't matter. The panel is showing us Black Canary's ass.
Yeah.
Is that artist. So I already don't like him. This is very early work. It looks like McFarlane meets Mike Diodato or something. You know, he's not quite Ed Benes yet. But when he does become Ed Benes, it's just ass shots and cleavage. So
that's what happens. The 90s was pre-internet times.
No. There's no excuse for Ed Benes's Justice League because that's in the 2000s. That's mid 2000s and later.
And that's what I'm saying. It's horrible because we don't need to see tits and ass in comics. They're readily available. So please, can we just have stories? I'm so tired of that.
If we talk about how they recap things in this, which is one of the interests of the Zero issue, they just recap it through various conversations. There's no real focus. There's no flashback element, really. It's like different conversations are going to tell us different parts of the story. So that's one way to do it.
The story is so weak also. I mean, I didn't even care at the end because he kind of won. You know, Gunfire wins. He makes the whole thing explode. His dad survives. I mean, but that there's no lesson.
Tell
in that.
Me you're my dad. Oh, no, that's the other one. Yeah, tell me you're my dad. I mean, no, you're not my dad. Explodes the place. This is the damage story. This is damage all over again.
I mean, it's such a shitty story. He learns he has new powers all through the book. That's basically it. But there's no interest. There's no motivation. There's nothing there. I mean, he just wants to protect his shitty tech company, and he has new powers. So that's the synopsis. I mean, there's no story. There's nothing. I mean, his dad doesn't even reveal anything that's, you know, close to heart or who would, you know, motivate Gunfire to be anything more than just a shitty gambit. You know, there are no personal motivations. There's barely a story arc. I mean, this is just bad.
Would you be surprised to know that, you know, all these Bloodlines characters all showed up in an annual? So he was introduced in the Deathstroke annual.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah, that seems about it. So you're telling me that from this issue, you would not be reading Gunfire.
Not only would I not be reading Gunfire, I would be telling people this is a shitty comic book. Do not buy this.
All right. Well, I'm not buying Gunfire based on this either.
Oh, no. It was...
Even the premise. Back in the day, Gunfire, like, this is a new character, Gunfire. These are the books that were released like 6 months before Zero Hour. Anima, Gunfire, Damage. I can skip all of these. They're like, nothing in this lot even sounds interesting based on the name.
No, and I mean, they kind of sound like goof names, you know?
Well, the 90s had a lot of, like, if you look at, you know, people were scrambling to try and replicate the success of Image Comics. And okay, we're talking about the McFarlane, Rob Liefeld, Eric Larson, you know, like the originals. Even though those comics were total ripoffs of Marvel comics that those people were working on, give or take. Savage Dragon, I think, was an original creation, but the others are all, you can tell that's X-Men, you can tell that's whatever. Whatever they were working on, that's obviously like a redress or a reskin of that Marvel comic.
Yeah.
Give or take, especially visually. But the names at Image were all crap. I mean, if you look at Rob Liefeld, it's like characters are called Shaft and Badrock and whatever. You just put two words together or maybe not. Maybe just one word. Cable. You know, Cable is his idea from when he was at Marvel. Cable means nothing. If you look at the character, I guess he's got cables inside maybe because he's cyber. His original name for Cable was Cyber, I think. This is the 90s. Nomenclature of super characters. And that's exactly what they did with these series. It's like, what's a cool name? What's a cool sounding name? Gunfire, you know, it's a badass. It's like so generic in a way, you know?
It's generic and it's reminiscent of C-level supervillains. If they wanted to do something with all these awful extreme characters, make them all turn evil and just be an evil C-list gang. At least that would be interesting. I never got my shot. I was a contender. And, you know, and it turned evil. Gunfire should turn evil.
Well, he's handless now, so I don't know.
Bore him. Now I feel bad. Thank you.
Well, let's end this. Finally, we get to the infamous Xenobrood. Not only have I never read this 7-issue miniseries, which begins here with a number 0, I don't remember it being on the stands. And until I started doing research for the podcast, I did not recall its existence. We're about to see why, I guess. Issue 0 doesn't seem to say it's a miniseries. Issue 1 says it's a 7-issue miniseries, and then it never tells us again that it's a miniseries. So I don't know if they had hope for it to continue suddenly, but it did end at issue 6, you know, 0 to 6. So 7 issues.
Okay.
and it never appeared again. None of these characters ever appeared beyond that miniseries. They were not reused by anyone, including Doug Manchu as the co-creator here.
Oh, my. Well, it has to make a comeback in 2022.
Well, I don't know. It almost feels like Doug Mensch owns them. You know, it's like it doesn't say so. And I haven't found any evidence to that. But sometimes, you know, some creators kind of had something in their contract that it was theirs. Young Heroes in Love belonged to its creators. Sometimes it was more overt when, you know, like Chris Claremont's, I want to call him Sinister Six, but I don't, Sovereign Seven.
Okay.
Mike Baron's Butcher. If they don't want to do the stories, then nobody else can. It kind of feels like that. And then even Doug Mensch didn't want to do more Xenobrute stories, I guess. I don't know if that's the case, but it feels like that. Because when characters are introduced and then never reused, not even as cannon fodder, it's odd.
Yeah.
I'll do the synopsis here. Xenobrute number 0 by Doug Mensch, Tom Coker, and Keith Aiken. It's called Strange Brew. Archaeologist Zechariah Light finds a high-tech tube in a Sumerian site in Kuwait, and almost immediately, he's being attacked by ninjas, because it's the 90s. They mysteriously disappear just as they were going to kill him. So, as secretly as he can, he studies the cylinder and tries to make it open with the help of his ex-wife, Lorna. It eventually spits out crystals that become balls of protoplasm, that become humanoid lumps, that become superheroes, just in time to kill more attacking ninjas. Now they are born, and at his beck and call, like genies from a lamp. I mean, we didn't like the anima cover, but this is rough, man.
Oh, yeah, this is this is hard. It's quite horrible.
Tom Coker, like, drew and inked this cover. And in the interiors, he's got an inker, but here it's just him. It's not good. There's no background to speak of.
There's no depth. We don't know how big these characters are, really.
Yeah, and all the colors are they're clashing.
The shading is horrible and non-existent.
And even the title, Xenobrute, I don't mean to laugh at Xenobrute as a team name. It's not good. But the logo is just, let's break out a font.
Yeah.
And they put the X in a box, like to try to fool some idiot into buying an X-Men book.
Yeah.
You know, it's always got an X on it. It might be one of the X-Men family.
It isn't. I do not like this cover.
Well, it's very amateurish. Even the interiors, you kind of saw that style on sort of like ill-fated indie superhero comics that were, you know, made by non-professionals trying to break in to the business.
Yeah.
I don't dislike the inking by Keith Aiken. I like that thicker line.
It's very cartoony.
Yeah, I like that. But he can't save the awkward stances and the weird faces and the clothes. I mean, the thing with the ex-wife, Lorna.
Yeah.
Not a dislikable character, but she wears a blouse that contours her breasts in a way that even spandex shouldn't be able to do. You know, it's like, it doesn't look like real clothing. It's painted on to accentuate her breasts. It's like a second skin, basically. This is what's weird. I mean, and let's allow for someone to learn to draw, but his work in the 2000s is unrecognizable. Like, it's a completely different style. He did Blood and Water for Vertigo. He did Daredevil Noir at Marvel. Like, he's using, like, shadows and angular kind of... It's not at all like this. Not at all.
People evolve, they get better, and I think that's what happened.
He becomes a good artist. But this is like really early, and he's, I think, just like Len Wein doing the writing on Gunfire, I think he's trying to do the style of the day. He's trying to be an image artist. You know, he's trying to be Rob Liefeld, basically, or something.
Well, not really, because he can draw feet.
You know, he's hoping to be a better... I mean, there's a lot more detail in the backgrounds, and like a room might have a lot of stuff on a table. And none of these superheroes have a good... design.
No, not at all.
They're very basic. They're very generic. No, it's not going to do anything. But that said, I'm going to admit, I did not dislike this story.
You know what? I was going to say the same thing. I'm going to admit this was the best story of these four comic books. This was going somewhere. This was intriguing. I was like, ooh, what's going on? It's fun that the narrator is not the person with the powers and is basically a smart guy. There's a lot of nerds versus not nerds in this thing and computer. There's a lot of that. But, you know, at the end of this comic book, I was really like, whoa, well now. Okay, these superheroes have, you know, shitty costumes, but they're it kind of had like, where are they coming from? What are they? And are they what they seem type thing going on? And at the end of the comic book, I was intrigued.
Yeah, I think Zechariah Light, L-E-I-G-H-T, is a ridiculous 90s name. It's, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And the character himself, the design, isn't great. I mean, he's a scientist, but he's got all these novelty t-shirts. And parallel to this, I was reading the Hourman series from 99 to 2001 for some other project, which is an interesting contrast to the comics that we read for this episode, because it's a little bit like Damage, where he's got a legacy, and the legacy is both like Red Tornado, androids kind of stuff, and Hourman, and Hourman's got his own legacy, and still doing that way better than Damage did. But at the same time, it's a lot like this, where the main character isn't really Hourman, it's Snapper Carr. And Snapper Carr is wearing a novelty t-shirt every issue, a different one, like superhero themed. He's the one narrating. And it's kind of like this. He's kind of like this goofy but experienced character, Snapper, in the same way that Zechariah here is. So I felt like these were similar in tone, at least. I mean, Doug Mensch is a solid enough writer, so I wasn't expecting this to be a train wreck in terms of story. Just in terms of art, as soon as you flip through it, you realize, oh, he was paired up with someone who was just starting, and it's really showing. But yeah. I like the main characters. The relationship between the Zechariah and his ex-wife, which is friendly, which is the same relationship in Hourman between Snapper Carr and his ex-wife, Bethany. I'm telling you, that was like, there's like some sort of cross influence here across the years or something. I don't know if Hourman's writer read this and thought, well, there's a lot of untapped potential, or if it's just a coincidence, but there you go. But you don't know enough about the Brood itself.
Yeah, well, we know nothing at this point. We know nothing. They came from a what looks like a metal, perfectly smooth rod. And we don't know why they came out. We don't know where they're from. We don't know anything. But we do know they will, I guess, answer the call from, I don't remember the name of this guy because the name is just so 90s. What's Jebediah? What's his name?
Zechariah Light.
Zechariah. They kind of appear in dreams or not really.
He's in, like, they're communicating with him when they're balls. Even when they're just in the cylinder, they are protecting him. You know, they like they zap the ninjas disappear. Well, they have a teleporter in the group, and she's sending the ninjas somewhere else. And as we find out here, when she gets rid of the ninjas, she teleports them in orbit around the moon.
Yeah, which does.
I think is pretty badass. You know, so and they're like there's a bruiser, there's probably a mental person, you know.
Oh, yeah. They're all in there. There's the psychic. There's the hand blast guy. There's the tough guy. Because
they're not named is the reason that why we're just going. There's the energy blaster. Yeah. So I did a little research, of course, to just like cover all the bases. And here are the characters are, there's Astra, who can possess people a bit like Jericho. So she's the girl with the just like the reverse ponytail.
Yeah, with the long bang.
The one long bang. Again, very 90s. Blip is the teleporter. That's the woman in green. Thrasher is the super strong brute, like the big guy. And get this. I love this name. Zap-Attack is the one firing energy blast. So
Zap-Attack. Terrible. It's so bad.
So the names, like these guys, were not going to survive the 90s or even their own miniseries, as it turns out. Just because the names are so awful.
Oh, yeah.
So basically, the miniseries has Zechariah discover who they are, what they are, and they fight the villain, who is one of the aliens who brought the Xenobrood to Earth in the first place, back in the dawn of civilization, basically. Like, these aliens would bring this genetic material that they would turn into slaves, basically, or people that would build the pyramids you know, with their powers. It intersects with the DCU only mildly. Superman appears in issues 3 and 4. And as far as a legacy, the aliens who created the Xenobrood are possibly suggested that they are possibly the ones who inserted the metagene into the human genome.
Oh, okay.
According to this series, obviously. And so obviously that was ignored later, or nobody's followed up on it because nobody remembers Xenobrood.
Well, they're going to remember now.
Well, some people do, because people have been snickering at us since the beginning. As soon as we said we were going to do zero issues, there were people going, oh, Xenobrood, can't wait for Xenobrood. So they're laughing at us that we had to go through this. But really, it's just, it's an eyesore, but I don't think it's a bad story. I think it's, you know, it's terminally 90s. It could not survive past the 90s just because of the designs, the names and the designs. But as far as like the story, I think it writes a check it can't cash. If you look at that issue's text page, the editor talks about what went into it, what, you know, what were the thoughts, why is this interesting, and where is it going, sort of thing. And it does make a point of the genie in the lamp. Like, it was found in the Middle East, the cylinder. And this is a nerd, if we talk about Zek. He's a nerd, so what would be his wish? And it's like, unconsciously, he's been wishing for a life of superheroes and adventure. And his genies are thus superheroes. And then what would you do with those powers? What would you do with the wishes? The Xenobrood are sort of childlike characters who don't know the universe. Everything they know, they learn through mental contact with him.
Okay.
So they're very young and innocent. And they say, you know, we're at your beck and call. So if you had a quartet of superheroes as your genies under your control, what would you do with it? And it sort of implies that this is going to go ways that superhero books don't usually. Like, would you stop all war? Would you fix famines? What would you do with those powers? Knowing that the series is really about fighting like an alien supervillain at the end, who's sort of responsible for their presence there, and who's, I don't know, I guess immortal, and he's been hiding on Earth since then. Well, I don't think it goes anywhere that's particularly special. So that's what I mean by making sort of these promises that it doesn't manage to keep. If it had gone on longer, I don't know, maybe. But what's interesting about the series is maybe not the direction they actually went in. That said, would you read Xenobrood based on this zero issue?
Oh my God, I can't believe I'm saying this, but yes, I would. I want to see issue one. I want to know what's going on.
Big surprise. And I feel the same way. I think at the time, if I read this, I probably would not have read it in the same sitting as three terrible comics.
No, yeah.
So maybe by comparison, it sort of survives. But it is definitely the best of the four books. And the one, if I had to choose one, I would continue reading this one.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And since it's only a miniseries, It's not like a big investment.
Exactly. And like you said, it's an eyesore, but the story is, up to this point, pretty good, at least intriguing. So there's nothing worse than a boring story, and this one isn't boring.
Yeah, it's just the art is often weak.
Yeah, the art kind of feels, it doesn't feel like a DC book. It feels like an indie book.
That's a passion project for a local creative team or something.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't feel like a DC book, but it's still not that bad up to this point. I mean, I probably will be proven wrong, but up to this point, I'm saying yes to issue one.
Controversial. So we'll take another promo break, and when we come back, your feedback from our previous episode.
Ooh.
Attention, attention all personnel. New from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, it's MASHcast. Hosted by MASH mega fan Rob Kelly and a rotating cast of VIPs, MASHcast analyzes, episode by episode, the greatest television series of all time, MASH. Find MASHcast on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Letters lost in time.
Letters lost in time.
Excerpts from your comments on our coverage of the Legion-related zero issues. That's LSH, Legionnaires, Rebels, and Lobo. So Santiago started listening to the show fairly recently and just caught up. Despite our gripes, he still thinks Zero Hour is the best book ever.
Ooh.
You will not be dissuaded. Brian Linton admits these zero issues were his jumping on point for the Legion. But not for Rebels or Lobo,
okay.
Which is a frequent comment that we got. David S. Gutierrez jumped onto Legion twice with the 5 years later and then with this reboot. But while he says he loved 5YL, this was his Legion. He held on to the end, and the Abnett and Lanning arrow was even his favorite. He never got the appeal of Lobo, see? Martin Gray says, I was wary of this Zero Hour Legion reboot, but it worked out brilliantly. There was a freshness and familiarity to the proceedings. We got lots of the old favorite characters and some great new ones, such as Kinetics and Monstrous, and crap ones like Snecky, but you have to have some crap Legionnaires. Now, I'll disagree with Martin with his assessment of a Projectra. The Projectra in the reboot era was a big snake. Like, she was a giant snake.
Okay.
Like, looked like a snake. Not like a humanoid snake. A snake with little robot arms so she could so she could use technology or whatever. I loved her to bits. Shotgun and I, when we reviewed the whole thing, Snecky, as he calls her, like Jackie, the snake version of Projectra, we loved her. It was one of our favorite Legionnaires. At least until they decided to turn her into a sexy snake lady. So that's when you kind of ruined it.
Yeah, yeah. Don't turn snakes into sexy.
It was so charming as just a snake. So for Ange, this was a jumping off point. Once Rock was the time trapper in the Zero Hour issues, I felt I had seen it all. Jumping onto a new reality seemed too crazy. You missed out, Ange. Tim Price loved the reboot Legion. He followed it for years and only stopped for financial reasons. Like several of our listeners, Rebels didn't grab him as much as Legion did. He also reminds us that everything in Lobo number 0 was actually revealed in the first Lobo miniseries, albeit in a text piece, including the heavy metal brain implant and killing everyone with killer bugs or insects or virus or whatever. So I guess we can only blame Lobo number 0 for not changing that last bit. Chris Franklin says, I don't know why I didn't jump in on the Legion books with this reboot. I remember liking what I saw from afar, and I had even bought the first several issues of Legionnaires just because I liked the idea of the classic, a younger Legion in modern stories. He also says, I liked Lobo fine on his own, but in the DCU, no thanks. As related on JLU cast, his very presence in the DCU makes the rest of the heroes, especially Superman, whom he has frequently interacted with, seem neutered and ineffectual. The guy wiped out his whole planet for fun, and no one is going to consider him a major threat to the universe and bring him in. It's a fun satire, but it has no business being in the DCU when they take the character to those extremes, in my opinion. If the worst parts of Lobo from his solo series were myth in the DCU, that would be a bit different. Captain Entropy had this to say about Rebels. If you want a true story about a heroic archivist fighting oppression by preserving the truth, I recommend looking up Vasily Mitrokhin and the Mitrokhin Archive, or reading the book The Sword and the Shield. Mitrokhin had a great vantage point to tell the truth about the Soviet Union from inside the KGB. Check it out. And finally, Diablo Frank left a long comment that, among other things, makes comparisons to porn mags, calling Lobo the hustler of antiheroes, vulgar and marinated in toxic masculinity. He says that when he worked in a comic book store, he had a customer or two who came to the store solely for Lobo. He says, I think a lot of people who despise the character do so because he holds up a mirror to the worst impulses of fandom. That's why I refuse to dismiss Lobo, even though I generally avoid him while continuing to indulge in other hyper-violent comics that have a flair that better suits my tastes and doesn't make me feel badly about them. You know, like Penthouse. So I guess I know what he likes. So Martial Law. Martial Law is like the Penthouse of hyper-violent comics if Lobo is Hustler.
Okay.
Anyway, you need to read the comment entirely to get all the goods. On that note, we have to mention that the Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page. So if you like our content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Get on the zero list at patreon.com/FW podcasts, just like these fine folks did. They got on the zero list, which means they are going to escape the cataclysmic time wave that's coming from both ends of history. You know how it works. Jim Baal has been saved from Naboo's tomb and won't lose himself to the Lords of Order. David Capoon has been saved from a wrong number in Fairfax, Maine. Maybe a deep cut. Michael Bailey has been saved from the sinking Statue of Liberty in the middle of the Great Disaster, and Diablo Frank has been saved from Earth 3 as the Angelo Frank spotted him in the crowd. A reminder that you can leave comments as well at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also follow the Fire and Water Facebook page or on Twitter. The account is FW Podcast. You can also, of course, listen to the podcast on Spotify.
Next time on Zero Hour Strikes, the Spectre, the Demon, and Sandman?